Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The sort of irony is that when they hit substances that they regarded as in some sense alien and horrific, they couldn't apply the same doctrine as they applied to nicotine and alcohol, which is control and tax. They just banned, and it's at that point that all the wrong things happen. Of which the chief one, which obsessed me, was supply. You can't control demand of something that people do not believe is doing them serious harm until it really is doing them serious harm. The question is the suppliers. And I just felt from the beginning that to try and ban, arrest, control, limit, eliminate the suppliers is like saying, you can drive your car, but it's illegal to sell you petrol. It's not going to work. It didn't work.
Sir Simon Jenkins has been at the forefront of this issue for a very long time. He's written about it for The Guardian. He's been involved in influential reports. He's also got lived experience, which always helps. And I think this is the first Knight of the Realm that we've had on the podcast. So thank you so much to Sir Simon Jenkins. You're listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces Network, brought to you by Acast in association with Leet UK. Here we go.
Behind your barricade. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind your barricades, where true values seldom stray.
Thank you so much for joining us again. As I said, we're talking to Sir Simon Jenkins, and it's a personal privilege for me. And I'm pretty sure the rest of us can agree with that, because we're also with J.S. Raffaelli and Neil Woods, colleagues of mine. Both of them have written a book called Drug Wars, which is out at the moment, and I very much urge you to go and get it. It's a perfect one to put on your list, along with their previous book, Good Cop, Bad War, which is all about Neil Woods' story as an undercover cop. Let's get straight on with this, because there's so much to unpack. So we're talking with Simon Jenkins in his house about drug war history. I can't believe we're here with Simon Jenkins in Simon Jenkins' house with J.S. Raffaelli and Neil Woods, because we're going to be talking about, well, all sorts, because I think it's fair to say that Simon has been pretty much at the forefront of this issue, certainly in journalism terms, for a very long time, because the war on drugs, in quotation marks, we kind of still use that terminology, it's been a contentious issue since the 70s and beyond that, but you've been one of the first people to really champion the issue of reform. At what point did things start to connect for you that actually we might want to do things differently?
Well, I can't remember drugs at university. That shows how old I am. It really wasn't an issue. I mean, a few weirdos took dope and so on, or I don't know what we called it then. And it wasn't until I came to London to work and began to cover drugs as an issue in London. And that was exclusively heroin. I mean, heroin was the issue then. That I became aware of it. It wasn't a problem, and the concept of there being a war on it would have seemed ludicrous. There was a problem with it, and that problem was with a few hundred, never more than a thousand or so, addicts. And these addicts, a lot of them were nurses, they were people in the medical profession, they were people who, for some reason or another, had become addicted to heroin, and it was legal. They had to get a prescription. And I used to cover the queue at the Boots pharmacy at midnight, one all-night pharmacy in London, when they got their shot for the new day. And we regarded them as rather sad figures who needed sympathy. There was a vicar who used to preach to them and try and help them. It was at no point a sort of threat to society. And it wasn't until the a few doctors started rogue prescribing that the thing sort of started to get out of hand, and that was illegal. And the law started to get involved with basically disciplining doctors. But it wasn't for some time after that that the thing became a kind of a major issue, and in particular, marijuana became an issue.
That's the perfect segue, because just before, as we were setting up, we were talking about this very issue, the fact that you was covering the line in Boots. We'll get to JS and Neil on that very, very shortly, because I know you're itching to speak on that, because it's covered in the new book. But what was that like? What was the as you said, the demographic of the people was probably very different to what we perceive. You said it's not who you think of, you know, the stereotypical addicts, which I again are using quotation marks. How was that queue look into your eyes back then?
My recollection is it was basically people not unlike me who'd fallen on rough times in some way. I mean, the dossers, the people sitting around fires in the East End were on meths or something else. But it was nothing that we talk about now, and it's really what fascinated me as the years rolled by was how we created a problem out of no problem.
JS, I'm going to bring you in on this because it's covered in the book, isn't it? Drug Wars. At what point for you did you start thinking this is an interesting topic?
Well, I've had a personal and professional interest in drugs since my teenage years. So I was interested in this as an issue my whole life, and then obviously worked with Neil on the first book. But it was really interesting what Simon just said, and it is absolutely, that's very much the story that we were telling. Once you begin to dig into this, the history from a historical research point of view, you start uncovering these statistics. Like, I don't have the exact numbers to hand, but like between 1959 and 1964. The number of heroin addicts in the UK would rise from 96 to 342. And I remember 342 is a real number. And this was considered a real scandal and crisis, that there were 342 heroin addicts. And when the Misuse of Drugs Act was eventually passed in 1971, how many heroin addicts were there in the entire UK? 1,049. And we've gone from that to several hundred thousand now. But the idea that there was a time in living memory where you could count, you know, the number of heroin addicts in the entire country could fail to fill a small music hall.
It's incredible, isn't it? And Neil, this is where your work comes in, because you've got a lived experience of this. You were the person that was ultimately charged with arresting the people that we thought was a problematic consumer. What was that like within your job? And you cover it within both your books, but it must have been a nightmare, surely.
Well, the thing is, when I started, I believed in what I was doing, though, because I believed in what I'd been told, that this was a terrible problem that we need to fight and fight as hard as we could to try and win. But only by actually looking at the history that we can see, as Simon's just said, that this is a problem of our own creation. There was no problem until we perceived it as such and tried to do something about it. It's really shocking just how much the increase from 1,000 up to 350,000 only 20 years later. I mean, that's horrific, and the cause and effect is really quite clear. But so, I mean, you asked me what it was like dealing with it, but you know, when I was actually working undercover, trying to catch the drug dealers, the people I was manipulating and sort of causing harm to were problematic heroin users, but they wouldn't have existed without the policy.
And this is why it's a thrill to speak to you, Simon, because again, the historical element that you bring to this, the fact that if we retrace our steps, we may be able to work out where we've gone wrong. Is it important we look back and think, actually, there was things we could have done differently?
Well, you've got to put it in something of a sort of social context. Clearly, as a big city like London gets richer, as it develops leisure habits and tastes that aren't necessarily legal, it was likely that marijuana would become a problem. It was likely that ecstasy would become a problem. It was therefore likely that cocaine and heroin would become problems in some sense. The question to me is not could you have stopped that happening? I don't think you realistically could. The question is, how do you react to it as a society? And the interesting thing about all Western countries is they reacted with horror. These were taboo products. They weren't alcohol, they weren't nicotine, which they could understand and they felt they could control. To a certain extent, they were right. The sort of irony is that when they hit substances that they regarded as in some sense alien and horrific, they couldn't apply the same doctrine as they applied to nicotine and alcohol, which is control and tax. They just banned, and it's at that point that all the wrong things happen, of which the chief one, which obsessed me, was supply. You can't control demand of something that people do not believe is doing them serious harm until it really is doing them serious harm. The question is the suppliers. And I just felt from the beginning that to try and ban, arrest, control, limit, eliminate the suppliers is like saying, you can drive your car, but it's illegal to sell you petrol. It's not going to work. It didn't work.
Feel free to jump in, by the way, Jess, because I saw you as kind of...
I wanted to respond to something that Simon said before, a phrase you said. We all thought of them as quite sad cases when you see these guys outside Boots. And I think there's something really interesting in that, which speaks to stuff that that I discovered anyway. Neil might have already known about it as we were writing the book, which is an attitude. It's not just about the number of heroin addicts that there were. It's about the way that they were regarded. And it's a particularly British mode of regarding them, not as moral failures. And there was if you read the discussions from the time, there was no language about that they were evil or that they were failures in a moral sense. They were regarded as unfortunate cases. The moral condemnation came from an American conversation, an American rhetoric, an American way of speaking. Which was directly contrary to the British way of doing things. And the prohibition of drugs, really the story that we tell, and a huge discovery for me in writing the book, was that there was a thing called the British system. It was a British way of doing things, which was an absolute contradiction to the American guns and ammo prohibition approach, and was internationally known in policy circles as the British system, but has been completely written out of the story. It's a lost thread of British history. So it was very exciting for us to like uncover that. And now, whenever we do speak on this, the first thing I say is, who's heard of the British system? Nobody's heard of it. It's been written out of our story. And to me, it speaks to like really profound things in like the British intellectual and political tradition, very precious, liberal, pragmatic traditions. And I think that's all true for you as well, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. But no one's heard of it because the history is generally written by the victors, isn't it? And the drug prohibition is American moral imperialism, and they did win.
For now.
Wait a minute. They'll be the ones that cure it. I have huge faith in America.
Oh no, absolutely.
I mean, I'm just on my way to LA at the moment. I mean, yeah. The solution will be for the problem is in America, and the solution is going to be in America. But that's a prediction.
Yeah, okay. Well, I hope so. I mean, they're certainly proving what you've said with cannabis, what they're doing in California, going live this year, is going to be huge, I think. But I think it's interesting that the central drug that we're talking about is heroin, because for drug wars, we studied the. The debates for the Misuse of Drugs Act, both before and after the election, led by a Labour Home Secretary and then a Conservative. And those debates were lots of boring stuff in there, but some absolutely fascinating stuff as well. Because it was quite clear that what the politicians were scared about was heroin. And it was quite clear that they didn't understand at all that every other drug isn't heroin. They most of them had no idea of the concept of the difference between cannabis and heroin and the various risks and the comparative risks. So it was the fear of that drug being fueled by American pamphlets that actually drove the whole debate and the whole shift.
I remember I was in America a lot at the time, and I remember arguments with people precisely along the terms that you're saying. And I remember, some American says to me, your country's so left-wing. We were communist at the time, was their view. You've got this thing, you get drugs on prescriptions. And I said, no, we can get heroin on prescriptions. We get heroin on prescriptions because these people need help. And that's the way we have it's your National Health Service, it's communist, you see. And I said, is yours going to work, shooting them? the trouble with Americans is they just love criminals. I mean, you've got a whole new class of people they're going to declare criminals. And that's the way you keep the American police employed. You've got to have an endlessly new immigrants, whatever it might be, they're all criminals. And we've got to lock them up. very pro-American normally, but not in matters penal. But what was interesting, I think, was the way in which what you, Neil, described as being this interesting attitude to heroin, then is transferred into what at the time was not a big thing. It was rather sort of party drug, marijuana, but it just wasn't very prevalent. And then suddenly marijuana explodes because just people like it. And it's vast numbers of people start taking, and you know, as the 60s progressed and we went to parties and so on, I didn't myself, but I mean, it was a kind of relatively speaking alternative thing to do, to take this stuff. And the fact that it was illegal was absolutely of no consequence at all. And a lot of people were going to prison. It was always thought to be rather like crossing no man's land in the First World War. You know, one of your friends got bust, and that was terribly bad luck. But from then on, the thing just snowballed, and it was almost as if a police industry, of which you were a part, a police industry was developing, in which you got a whole new cause celeb, which politicians were loading onto you. And the politicians didn't really want to know that you were winning. They just wanted to know you got a good battle going, because, you know, fighting drugs sounded good.
Yeah, absolutely. And from our perspective, from my point of view as a police officer, a former police officer, the police were really well and truly stitched up by mm-hmm. being given drugs to control, because there is no policing solution to drugs at all. And that's where the big breaches in Peel's principles came. Both Principle 7, that the police are the community and the community are the police, that was breached. But perhaps most importantly, is it Peel's Principle number 9, that the evidence of successful policing should not be for the policing to seen to be happen. I've worded that terribly, but you know the one. I mean, the one I mean, where police activity is not proof of police success is probably a better way of putting it. But unfortunately, we have this world of photo op policing where or the Royal Navy or the National Crime Agency will photograph tons of cocaine and show this as evidence of success without ever being honest. That we don't actually seize more than 1% of the overall percentage that's imported of any commodity. It's less than any business losses of any international corporation. And, you know, if we had that honesty at the same time as those photographs and that photo op policing, then perhaps the public would have a different view. But that honesty is not there.
And maybe without tacking 4 zeros onto the end of every estimated street value. Well, whenever
I remember having a conversation when I was on the Ron Simmons Committee, the Police Foundation on Drugs. We did talk to a few people who purported to be dealers, or one or two of them really were. But I always remember references to these big busts when they were seizing vast quantities of cocaine and whatever it was. And they always said, oh, it's our best day when you see that. You know the price is going to go up. And, you know, we you know, as long as it wasn't us. But I mean, the idea that seizing quantities of stuff is a victory is crazy. It just increases the price.
Well, actually it doesn't, because I bought heroin between 1993 on the streets and in 2007. And I was paying £10 for a 0.12 of a gram deal. In 1993, it was the same average weight in 2007, which I paid £10 for. And over that period of time, the average purity went up. So what other commodity is so inflation-proof you would be paying the same amount for over that period of time? And the strength would go up. So it doesn't have that impact. Since drugs were banned, they've all, over time, got stronger, more dangerous and more varied.
Yeah, go for it, Jess. Yeah, I want to come back to two things that you said, which are really interesting. One about the American conversation. Just, I don't want to derail back to that, but I don't want to forget to mention this either. That though that American conversation you're having is also inseparable from the American conversation around race, and how each of these drugs, and a lot of what we trace back in drug wars, is heroin was attached to the Chinese and opium very early on, from the 1880s. And there was a tabloid, feverish tabloid press around this: cocaine to African Americans, cannabis to Latin Americans, Mexicans. And the conversation around drugs and the prohibition of drugs and the insane American conversation around race are threaded together. The roots are intertwined, and one cannot be taught, and that in a way which was exported here, and of how the tabloid press reported drugs here, and a kind of imitation of the yellow press in America, which had a hugely deleterious impact on the national conversation and the national consciousness of what drugs were.
I'm sure that's true, yeah.
The other point, which is a really interesting thing, you talk about the economy, a policing economy was born. It's a really great way of putting it. And what we saw in drug wars from the sort of 70s till now is actually like twin economies were born. It was really interesting because in the 70s, early 70s, there were very few drug dealers. Obviously, there were very few drug takers. And the aristocracy of the drug world were like the armed robbers. And we talked to guys who were like, who came up in that era, and as drugs came in, they were like, yeah, of course I became a drug dealer. Of course, why am I going to go out and rob a bank? Why am I going to knock over a security van when I can make more money every day with less risk of getting shot by selling drugs? So very quickly what happened is the aristocracy of the criminal world became the drug gangs. And now you're in a situation where you can add up all the other criminal enterprises, add them all together, and you won't get a fraction of what people make out of drugs, and drugs form the capital, which is then reinvested in other criminal enterprises. On the flip side, the parallel is within the police in the late 60s and early 70s. If you were a cop, the last place you wanted to be was on the drug squad, because it was like basically a traffic warden. It was like the geek thing. You know, you want to be out on the flying squad and catching, you know, catching bank robbers and murderers. And what Neil describes over his career, you see how the drug squads became the rock stars of the police, and they get the funding, and it's this really weird parallel economies, and one feeds the other. So it was very interesting to hear you talk about that.
Well, I can remember what was the name of the police chief in the 60s under Roy Jenkins, the great reformer, Robert.
Yes, I know who you mean.
We'll Google it and put a link.
Yeah, what was it? Yeah. We had lunch with this with. His book upstairs. Anyway, we had lunch with the chief of the Met in the early 60s, it was. No, it wasn't the early 60s, it was the late 60s. And those days, there was real trouble with the CID. And the CID were in league with bank robbers, perfectly clearly. And he said, I'm going to wind up the CID. And he wound up the CID. It was the most amazing row about it. He had Roy Jenkins right behind him, who was Home Secretary at the time. And he said, and we said, you're going to do what? What about all these bank robberies? He said, they will stop. I always remember him saying, they will stop. We said, you're telling us the bank robbers will stop when you wound up the CID. Yes, they will stop. And they stopped. It was unbelievable. He said, every single one. I mean, the bank's pretty well protected. Every single one is an inside job. And the inside job involved the police. My worry, he said, is what they go on to next. And it's exactly what you're saying. The policemen were making serious money out of banks, bank robberies. They went on to making serious money out of drugs. And I was sitting next to a former cop with the Met, who was there 2 or 3 years in the Met, having come down from York. And he said, I could stand it for 2 years and had to give up. I couldn't handle the corruption. And he said, I said, well, what's it like in York? He said, it's nothing like the Met. Mm-hmm. And I said, is it really that bad? You know, this is recently, this is in the last 10 years. He said, it's the drugs. He said, it just is absolutely impossible. You cannot, he's totally of your persuasion, you cannot control a market for which there's a huge demand.
You must have seen that in what you did, Neil, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, nowadays we have a situation where the kind of corruption that I've seen could not be paid for with any other kind of criminality, because we're so very good with CCTV and other ways of investigating crime. But there's never been anything in the scale of the illicit drugs market anyway. I mean, in Good Cop, Bad War, I talk about having my team infiltrated by an employee of Colin Gunn's group. He was paid £2,000 a month on top of his police wages, plus bonuses for good information. And by the time I met him and thankfully sussed him out, he'd been in the police for 7 years.
Seven
years passing information to one of the nastiest organised crime groups in the country.
How does it get away for that amount of time, for 7 years? That's just inconceivable, isn't
it? There's very little defence against this. I mean, you have to face the fact that he was paid by Colin Gunn to join the police as a young man, and that's the obvious tactic. To try and infiltrate police, it's the most effective way of doing it. You can't defend against that. So, in in the debriefs for that situation, senior police and various ones from Nottinghamshire have said to me since that we accept, they've said to me, Woodsy, we accept this happens. You know, with this much money involved, how can this not happen? That in itself should be enough reason to reform straight away. We should not be allowing such corruption.
I mean, I got to know, as a journalist, most chiefs of police over the past 20 or 30 years, including, I have to say, most impressively now, Cressida Dick. They all say the same thing, which is what you just said, to which the next question is, well, what can you do about it? Because all city police are vulnerable to this kind of corruption, pollution. And the kind of method tended to be to form a special unit that's not corrupt. And that's why you've got 20 or 30 effectively private armies in the Met now. And they're unreformable because they are really tight-knit. They're fraternities within fraternities. And they all say the same thing. Well, we set these up to bust the ones that you haven't yet bust. Then they become problematic in themselves. The question is, how do you... Well, then at least you can disband them and put the guys back on the street, or whatever it is. But, of course, it is a very unsatisfactory way of running a police force, not to mention running a city. And now, what interests me now about the whole thing, which is why I think the situation is more serious than it's ever been now, is, of course, as you were saying, that crime needs to fund itself, and it funds itself through other forms of crime, in this case, through drugs. The worst thing that's happened in London in the last 10 years is the gangs. And it's the relationship between new groups coming into London, looking for security, finding it within their group, and their group becomes a gang. And the gang has to find a way of financing itself. It does it through drugs. And that to me is a really poisonous way of running a city. But you will not attack that until you get rid of the drugs as the issue. They may find secondhand cars or something else to do it with, but they'll have to find something else, because at the moment the money's so good out of drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. But you, quite often when I debate police officers, one of the things they will say is, well, it's pointless getting rid of the drug markets because the criminals will just find other criminal things to do, which is very illogical, because crime's not caused by criminals, it's caused by opportunity. And the opportunities for other crimes are already being taken, apart from those crimes which need massive investment with money, and the money would come from the drugs. So actually you reduce all of the forms of criminality by removing the black market. But that's not... I don't think that's a complicated thing to understand, and I think most police will understand that. But the reform, the leading voices of reform are increasingly from police, for example in Durham or North Wales or Birmingham. And I predict and hope that they will continue to be so, because we need to be honest about what we're seeing, I think.
Yeah, and certainly in what we're saying about corruption, the last two chapters of Drug Wars is specifically about police corruption. And the last chapter in particular is, I mean, we talked to this guy who was a very high-level cop running high-level informants, running witness protection. He eventually had to be put into witness protection himself because he became a whistleblower about racism and corruption in the Met. And the worry was that his corrupt police colleagues were going to take a hit out on him using their own network of informants. What he describes is such deep endemic corruption. And he's very clear, and the evidence is very clear, that form of corruption can only come from the illicit drugs market. And yes, there was, back in the day, the bank robbers colluded with the flying squad, and there was definitely a problem. But comparing that to what's going on now is comparing a semi-severe hangover with the bubonic plague. It's just different leagues.
Yeah.
It's different leagues. It's
I'm interested to pick up on the objection that if we give up on drugs, they'll find something else, or that there's always a market for the illicit. There's illicit cigarettes, illicit hooch, and so on. They're not big markets, but there's no point in doing it because something else you're going to posit is going to be worse. I just don't buy into that, and I'm fascinated to watch now in Los Angeles or in California and in Colorado and Washington State and so on, what is really happening? What is happening to the people who used to peddle marijuana? Well, the answer is most of them are still peddling marijuana. They aren't going to prison. But I mean, the absurdity of it here is you've got kind of squalid deals taking place behind pubs, you know, all over London. Whereas in my son's part of California, you know, their courses now in tasting different sorts of marijuana. There's sommelier classes.
Courses, yeah.
I mean, it is now very, very high grade. Sonoma County, the actual vineyards are being converted to marijuana fields. I mean, this is now a totally legitimate industry. Now, I'm sure there's trouble on the cocaine front. I just don't know about that. But clearly, the concept of going legitimate with marijuana is no different from going legitimate with alcohol back in the Prohibition period. The only way you get crack this, I think, is just by publicizing all this. I kind of write as often as I can. I write about you know, going to a marijuana tasting in L.A. or whatever it might be, because we're looking primitive in this country now. We're just looking primitive. No other word for it.
From being absolute world leaders, from a position that Britain occupied for so long with the British system as an absolute world leader and the invention of what we call harm reduction, the whole strategy of harm reduction is a British invention. It springs out of a British intellectual tradition in a really, again, it's just a very precious way of thinking, the liberal pragmatism that was born in this country. And we've completely lost it. I mean, it's tragic, and it's something that could be reclaimed. It's ground that we could lead again, very without breaking sweat. It wouldn't be hard. It would just take a bit of moral courage from our leaders.
And this is really interesting because there's so much that I want to get to there. Because I was reading some of your old articles, Simon, and you bring up the point that something that we address, and it's something that kind of JS touched upon with what we're doing with race issues. You know, how it just completely gets balled up and raked up within the drug war. But you also brought up the historical precedent of the moralization of homosexuality and how we did start locking people up. We stopped locking people up for that. Can we draw parallels from that, or is that a little bit too crass? Can we actually still think in terms of this is a moral issue, and if you present it in the right terms, publicity-wise, people start to get it? Is that where journalists start to come into their own?
Well, I mean, I'm reluctant to ascribe too much power to journalists, but I'm also reluctant to let them off any hook. There's no doubt the Daily Mail has played a huge part in this. I mean, when we produced the Police Foundation report, which was pretty mild, I mean, I barely signed it. And I signed it because I just didn't see any point in not, because we were saying good things. But Jack Straw was the Home Secretary. He was telephoned by Alistair Campbell, who said, this thing's coming out, and if we look remotely soft on it, we're going to die, we'll be killed. You must write a piece right now for the News of the World, slamming it in advance. So Jack Straw did. Absurd piece came out. When it came out, the Daily Mail, whom I have to say Ruth Runciman had prepared fairly carefully, she's gone a lot of trouble with Paul Dacre, saying, you know, don't be unreasonable, you know. And Paul Dacre wrote a piece saying that this is a perfectly sensible report and we ought to take it quite seriously. We hadn't recommended legalization. We had recommended declassification of marijuana. Whereupon a humiliated Alistair Campbell calls up Jack Straw and says, you've got to write another piece saying it's a jolly good report. That was the level of the debate taking place, but it was revolving round the Daily Mail, much to my interest. Because actually, I remember at the time, most newspapers, the Daily Telegraph, at the Times, they were saying, we've got to move forward with this debate. It's silly to be locking people up for, you know, carrying around marijuana. There was a general consensus, which of course now is even stronger. What fascinates me, the reason why I will not go to a single drugs meeting ever again for the time being, is I do not want to discuss whether or not marijuana should be legalized. I want to discuss why it is that the establishment in Britain seems to find it so difficult to even discuss it. It's the problem is not about drugs. The problem is about power in Britain. And the reason why I just love America at the moment is the Americans are capable of cracking it. The British have not got the guts, or the British elite hasn't got the guts. Almost everybody, I'm sure if you had David Cameron, you know, with you now, or John Major, or anyone, they'd all say, oh, I think it's probably time, actually, and I'm sorry I didn't do more when I was in power.
Everyone says at the moment they retire.
Yeah.
Everyone.
I mean, every president across Latin America, they're all in favour.
Yeah, yeah.
We have seen that recently with Lord Hague. He came out, and there's just been so many.
Everyone says it the moment they retire.
Lord Falconer has apologised publicly
and hopefully
going to be a guest on this very show.
That was a big
moment. He did it with style,
absolutely.
That was good.
Pure class.
I get how they do it. The fact is, when they're in power, they haven't got the guts.
What you said about the Mail was very interesting. For the book, we interviewed Brian Paddock, who is a forward-thinking guy and a very clever guy and an ethically minded guy. And he did this experiment when he was police commander of Brixton of decriminalizing, and it broadly worked with mixed results, but it worked. But what the Mail did to him, of digging up some ex-lover and paying him to lie, and I'm allowed to say that because Paddock sued him and he won, so I'm not defaming the Mail here, like they defamed him, is an object lesson in why people are scared to talk about it. And you mentioned the Mail, and what they did to him was, I mean, I'm a member of the press, and I think it's morally unconscionable and breaks every journalistic ethical tradition that you could think of, and it's gross, and anyone involved in that should hang their head in shame.
Well, rolling forward, as I always try to do, how will we make progress? And we've made appallingly little progress over the years. I mean, on the whole, the police now are decriminalising in the literal sense of the word. But as far as I'm concerned, until you stop criminalising supply, you do not solve the problem. Mm-hmm. So the entire problem lies with supply. And that's true right across Europe. And even if European countries go on about how we've decriminalised and so on, the fact is that billions of euros and pounds and dollars are still being made trading drugs that ought to be made legitimately by ordinary organisations. And the thing I find so encouraging in America is the thing that people couldn't get their head around was the idea that crooks could become legitimate. Mm-hmm. Well, they haven't become legitimate. Legitimate people have taken over the crookery. I mean, they're selling marijuana. But it's no problem. I mean, they're conferences in London hotels about how to invest in marijuana companies now. In London.
I covered them, yeah.
You covered
it's
them?
Really interesting.
Well, there we are.
Yeah.
It is interesting, and it just shows that most predictions of doom don't apply. But I still do not see how we get a sort of core. I mean, the Home Office is clearly the key department, and the Home Office is unbelievably impervious to the concept of reform. It really is, as is the judiciary. And they're a part of the trouble because they still persist in sending people to prison for drug offences, which they don't have to do.
And that's fascinating because this is something that we speak about regularly, isn't it? How the US, they are leading. As much as you don't think that they're going to be as progressive as what we are, and like you said, liberally, but the state-by-state model that they've done, they're starting to get those dominoes to fall.
And when America changes, it changes fast.
It goes, doesn't it?
They go off.
We've spoken about how there is potentially some restorative justice going on with the industry, the fact that people with ethnic minorities and also disabilities are now getting in on the industry, and also expunging of criminal records so they can get in the industry. Do you think we're going to have more of a conversation out in the States?
In all honesty, I think you know more about that than I do.
All right.
And I think you should talk about it.
Oh, okay.
it was very interesting the other day. I did a piece about this, about America-Britain parallel. Donald Trump, when he came to power, insofar as one can discern anything from this guy, he said, I'm not going to get soft on drugs. I'm going to hold the federal government's against drugs. It's absolutely firm. The other day, someone picked it up. He was asked the question. He said he doesn't believe in interfering in states' freedoms. And this guy can change his mind, but it was a genuinely significant change. Mm. And you sense that he got the message.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
That's the thing, isn't it? It's once public opinion starts to lead, you start to see changes.
You've got Donald Trump on side, you're making progress.
Well, I think across the board on this, I think the politicians are behind the curve from the public. I think if they had a little moral courage, particularly in this country, I think the public are way ahead of them. I think, but I might be wrong.
Well, yeah, I mean, totally. I mean, I think the most a decent and substantive, I can't remember what the poll was, but there was a recent poll that said suggested 59% of the public supported cannabis reform, cannabis law reform. But there are the beginnings of a change within politics, though, because I spoke at a side event at the Labour Party conference, just at the recent conference, and it was a packed room. And it was hosted by Thangam Debonair and Jeff Smith, two very good MPs. They're not fringe MPs, they're both party whips. I think Thangam Debonair's got the biggest majority in the House, and they're people who've got a major future in the Labour Party, and they are leading an internal campaign for Labour to adopt drug law reform policies, and the support in that room was incredible. And one person stood up and said, I've been a member for 28 years, I've waited all of those years for this day. And that's the kind of energy in the comments. But it's not just Labour, you know. Crispin Blunt also has allies in the Conservatives, and he's brilliant on this topic, and quite courageous, I would say, as well.
No, the Daily Mail's changing too, I can tell you.
Quite yeah. I think
these are good times in theory. In fact, I'm actually more worried. I mean, I just know it'll come. I'm more worried about how we handle hard drugs, and not just hard drugs, but legal hard drugs. And, you know, I've got this problem in my family, and I just see the effective decontrol of the narcotics market in the wider sense of the word narcotics. And the one thing I don't want to see, I don't want to see a policeman anywhere near it. Whatever problems we got, they will not be solved by policemen, with all respect to your profession. Yeah. They will be solved by medics, by the care system, by the education system, whatever. But the idea that you destroy someone's life by criminalizing them is any sort of solution. We go back to, if you like, the morality of it all is just wrong.
I'll bring you in on this, JS, because that's a really good point, is that how we get listeners on this that have got no idea on drug policy. We manage to get entry-level people, so we're quite lucky on that. So how do we solve someone's concern of hard drugs, in quotation marks? What is the British system that you write about in Drug Wars?
So most of the drugs that we talk about, opium and stuff, were originally legal. You could buy them at high street stores. I'll give you the super fast version. As the 19th century turned into the 20th, new professional classes emerged, like pharmacists was a new idea, that you'd have a professional pharmacist, and a new civil service bureaucracy was created in the Home Office. And what immediately happened was there was a tussle, a sort of turf war between these two systems, two bureaucracies, about who was going to control these drugs. In America, the law enforcement guys were always going to do that. In Britain, what happened was the medical profession took over with loose control from the Home Office. And through that system, if you were a heroin addict, you got a prescription from your doctor. It was just not considered an issue which the police were the appropriate tool to deal with. What that has many effects on how a drug market works, but its main effect is that there's no black market. there's no incentive for anybody who is an addict to sell to another person to finance their own habit. And that, what I just described, is the main mechanism through which drug addiction spreads. If you look at the epidemiology of drug addiction, heroin addiction in particular, that's how it spreads. So if you're an addict, basically you have a choice. You can go out and steal £100 worth of stuff every day, which is quite a hassle. Or you get six other people addicted, become their supplier, and that finances your own habit. In a sentence, that's how heroin addiction spreads. What the British system does is completely eradicates that mechanism. Because why would you sell? You could just go to Boots. You get it from the NHS.
The British system used to.
Well, when it worked. That was the British system. Yeah. As soon as you cut that system, for instance, so there's a apocryphal rumors that are picked up from Kenneth Leach, the vicar, and others. It was sort of corroborated. Then in 63-64, the American New York Mafia held a big meeting in the Hilton Hotel here and was like, okay, how can we set up a drugs operation in London? And in fact, they decided, why bother? There's no market, because we can try and sell to people. We can get them addicted, but then they'll just go to the NHS. So there was no – they just decided not to set up a black market. As soon, I mean within weeks of that system being curtailed, the black market heroin started trickling in through Chinatown. The guys out of Hong Kong brought in, and the problem kind of metastasized from there into what we have today. And as soon as, and yeah, and it damages the police. I think most police would agree with you that the police are an inappropriate tool for which to deal with this problem. And when you try and use the wrong tool to fix a problem, you don't just not fix the problem, you damage the tool itself, and it's bad for the police.
I know, I take your point, Simon, that perhaps some of the answers now coming from the United States, but during that time when the British system was thriving, the United States still had a very aggressive foreign policy to try and persuade us and stop the British system. But the most ludicrous situation where, at the time in the 1950s, for example, when the United States was trying to persuade British politicians to follow the prohibitive way of doing things, they had hundreds of thousands of heroin addicts, and we had hundreds. And that evidence should have been so clear in the lead up to the Misuse of Drugs Act, but the debate was farcical, unfortunately.
But as I always say, like when it comes to drug policy, never underestimate the capacity of politicians to ignore evidence.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, the Misuse of Drugs Act, I remember it, was primarily directed at the fact that the illicit suppliers were in a sense undercutting the NHS. So it was almost sort of a benign concept, but it required classification and all these things to happen, which just got out of hand because the zest to control got the better of everybody. But I kind of started with a sort of old-fashioned neoliberal market economy approach to all this. I said, you know, just look at the market. What's the nature of the market? Where is the demand, and how does the demand meet supply? And I mean, what you said about how you make money as a heroin addict, is so true. I mean, we had a girl looked after our son, and when he was very small, she was actually a golden girl. She'd been a nurse, and I'd had a conversation with her. I'd had peritonitis or something. I had a shot of what it was, advanced morphine, and it was the best thing I've ever had in my life. And on day two, when he comes to give me a sleeping pill, I said, I want what I had last night. And then the nurse said, you can't have it. You can only have it once. Doctor says you can only have it once. And I said, I'm an NHS patient. I want my rights. I want what I had last night. And she said, you can't have it. It's totally forbidden to give it to you twice. And I said, well, you know, I want to know what it was, and I want to know. And it was interesting because this girl had said to us, well, she was in exactly the same position and she had it. And because she was a nurse, she could have it twice. And she became an addict as a nurse. Mm-hmm. Drops out of hospital because she becomes a serious addict, desperate, has a boyfriend who is an addict. And that was it. Now, she comes to us. We didn't know any of this. She's with us 2 or 3 years, vanishes one day in prison. Mm-hmm. I think to myself, what kind of system... Mm-hmm. What kind of problem is that the answer to? And it was the collapse of what you call the British system. And we haven't advanced on that in 20, 30 years.
You cover that in both books, Good Cop, Bad War and Drug Wars, Neil, and especially in your career, you must have seen how vulnerability was the precursor to a dependency, surely.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I spent a lot of time getting to know problematic heroin users. And I think something we haven't touched on here in particular, which I think is a very important thing to mention with heroin, is that it's not the chemical hook is the story. If someone, people can go into hospital and have that shot of morphine multiple times, and most people are going to have no problem and not get addicted to it, despite the theoretical idea that it's a chemical hook which causes it. It's not. There are plenty of academic studies which show that 2/3 of problematic heroin users are self-medicating for some kind of childhood trauma, either sexual abuse, physical abuse, or some kind of neglect. 2/3. It's not just me saying this, and many academics say it. And this is an important point to note, so that if at the times when I was picking on those problematic heroin users and manipulating people to introduce me to gangsters, what I was doing was manipulating people who were self-medicating to try and deal with the memories of their childhood. And this is the reality of drugs policing, where someone has a drugs problem, you're just making a miserable life more miserable. Instead of, and all of the amount of money that was invested in me and my activities, it would have been far cheaper to take care of those people.
If we come back to the role of the policeman in this, take another problem, which is mental health at the moment. Now, I mean, I've got a couple of friends who are policemen, and they're very interesting. They say, you know, just as the doctors always say, we're picking up the problems that the police should be dealing with, so the police are coping with problems the doctors should be dealing with. But in the grounds of mental health, and from what you're saying, so many people who are involved in the drugs business, in drug consumption, are there for a complicated psychological reason. They're not there. I mean, some of them are there because they just enjoy it, well, for God's sake. But most of them are not there for that reason. They're there because this is the response to them. Now, the recent question of cannabinoid medicines, which I just found in England is the very worst. We're beginning to crack it, but it was just awful. And now it's the same as the case with mental illness. And the idea that in some way that deploying the forces of law and order to handle these problems is the appropriate way of doing it is so primitive. It's just so backward. And I sort of feel for the police, because, I mean, the police are the last bastion of order against disorder. And when everything else has been withdrawn under austerity, whatever it may be, you're forced back to the person who picks up the wreckage. And the person who picks up the wreckage is the policeman, usually.
I saw this in action just last week. I was coming back from a conference on drug policy. And in St Pancras toilets, there was a vulnerable woman injecting, and the police were cordoned around it. And I was literally there thinking, what do I do? Can I get involved in this with the sector I'm in? And that must have been awful in the line of work that you were in, seeing that level of vulnerability, Neil, and yet still not being able to do what you think that you should do to be able to help them.
Call release.
That's
what you should do.
Should have done that, shouldn't I?
Because they provide legal...
Yes.
Specific legal advice to people in exactly that situation.
Yeah, I'll put a link into that in the scrolling bar. But you must have seen this tenfold.
Yeah, I have, but for many years, I saw the people really struggling with their existence, but I still sort of saw them as prey, to be honest, people who I could manipulate. I remember the event, which is in Good Cop, Bad War, when I'd got some heroin with three other people, and I was going to share a bag with somebody. But they all wanted to inject. So we went to these derelict toilets, which were just foul, dusty, horrible place. And they all started to inject. And I was having to step out of the squirts of blood from people's veins, you know, as it's sort of showering around me and blood dripping onto the powdered concrete and things. It was messy, but I was just seeing it as part of the job, you know, being horrified by it and having this great sympathy and wondering how fast I could get to a telephone box to report an overdose. But it was still, you know, the front line of policing is still about catching those people at the moment, and we just have to turn that around.
Because just give it a bit of an up. We've also. Neil and I have witnessed the reverse story to what you described, Simon, because we sat with a woman in her front room as she snorted prescription heroin from the UK government. There are still a few hundred people who do get prescription heroin. The British system never actually died. It sort of bubbled along under the surface. It was just curtailed. They did a classic British sort of political fudge where they like said, okay, you're allowed to do it, but you have to apply for a special license, and then just stopped issuing the licenses. But it did survive under the radar, and there are still people, a handful around, who get prescription heroin. Now, this woman had been a very long-term, is still a long-term heroin addict. She's been using about 45 years, and she was living a very chaotic life. Went through some really rough times in her life, a semi-abusive kind of home life from which she ran away. And she had supported her habit for years from selling to sex workers. She was arrested, but instead of putting her in prison, there was one forward-thinking probation officer who absolutely changed the course of this woman's life, because she had heard of this clinic in Liverpool run by this guy named Dr. Marks, who was prescribing heroin. And she went and she spoke to the guy, and he gave her a heroin prescription, which he has maintained to this day for 40-odd years, or however long, since the mid-80s. And the moment she got that prescription, she never bought from a drug dealer again. She had a regular supply. She's still a heroin addict now, but from that moment, she regularized her life. She got a job. She bought a flat. And we sat in her flat, which
she
owns.
Paid the mortgage off.
Paid the mortgage off. She has another flat which she rents. She still works full time. She has a daughter and a granddaughter who've never touched drugs. She's a citizen, a member of society, but she uses heroin every day still.
She's good company, actually.
And she's all right. Yeah, she's all right. She can tell the story. She's all right. She makes a good cup of tea. She's sweet. Yeah.
Yes, a lot of it's to do with the words you use, I think. I mean, I've been always fascinated by having once had colon cancer, how the word what words you use to describe it. Mm-hmm. And I met a person who was an oncologist, a brilliant woman, and she her special subject was the language of cancer. She said, "You mustn't say cancer. You must always use a definite or indefinite article."
Oh, yeah.
A cancer. If you've got a cancer and you've had it out, it's gone. You haven't got cancer anymore. If you've got cancer, it's a sort of death wish. And the same in a sense, I mean, the way you were talking about drugs there, I mean, the language we use to describe it, and the reason why I say like what's happening in California is they're talking about marijuana as if it was wine. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's on the wine pages of the bloody newspaper. It's coming into conversation in a way in which you're discussing taste and style and brand and image and all these things that go into discussing food and wine.
Or any other commodity.
As opposed to even not being a crime, but even being a problem.
Yeah.
It shouldn't see it as a problem. Now, I think making the leap, and it's the big one, making the leap from marijuana to cocaine and heroin, particularly to cocaine, is going to be difficult. Because, I mean, I can't quite see a cocaine sommelier, but maybe there's one in the making somewhere. But the way we discuss it is so important to the politics of it.
I don't want to monopolize, but I can't tell you how much I agree with what you're saying. Like, a huge thread of what we told in the book is like how the way things were reported in the press, and the tabloid press in Britain have like this peculiar power, because it's a centralized media landscape or something. But so I did an event with His name's gone. Duncan. He's a veteran crime reporter. He was the crime guy at The Guardian. Duncan. Scottish name. It's gone.
Duncan Campbell.
Campbell, yeah. He wrote Hack. Yeah. So we did this event together a few months ago. And we just read out a series of like quotes from British and American press from like the 30s, 20s and 30s, about the way they spoke about drugs and race. And these were like, it was gross stuff. I'm not going to soil your podcast with it. But every time we read out one of these quotes about black people doing cocaine or Mexicans doing weed or whatever, you could just see the audience wince. They just went, because we just don't talk in those words. We don't use those words anymore. And the point I'm trying to make at the end, and we say it in the book, is the way people talk in the press about vulnerable people who use drugs now, who are often self-medicating, like you said, Neil, in 10, 15, 20 years, we'll look back on the people who wrote these things about drug users today with the same wincing horror and cringing kind of like shame with which we talked about racism a few decades ago. And that's the prediction that we made. And I'd like, so word of warning to all you editors out there. Careful, on the internet it's forever.
I completely subscribe to that, absolutely. Right, so we can't thank Simon enough for doing this because, I don't think we can have a conversation like this with anybody else because you're so kind of rounded on this subject. So let's just quickly wrap up. Where do you think we're going to be in 5 years' time, if I can push you for a prediction?
We in Britain.
In Britain.
I think there's an answer to your question. A lot will depend on where we are in Europe because I mean, whatever we do with Brexit, we are one continent on these matters. If it's different, we always see when somewhere liberalises and the next door place doesn't, there's always a distortion of trade and you can't get a proper reading from it. So it doesn't matter what happens in Europe. But I think the whole of Europe will go the American way on marijuana. I really do. And I think that'll be the great breakthrough. Because the biggest money by far, I mean, was it 80-90% of the market in America is marijuana. And once that whole market is denied to the criminal class, and I don't think cocaine heroin is going to be anything like the prevalence that marijuana, and I don't know about other forms of drugs, I just don't know. But I do think it'll be better. I mean, I think there will be the breakthrough in this country that there has been in America. I really do think that. Heaven knows what form it'll take. But there's no reason why it shouldn't. I mean, we're not that different from California or Colorado, for goodness sake. But I think what will be interesting will be the way in which we react to all forms of self-harm, I'd almost say, but all forms of the way in which we allow people to live. It did start in many ways in the 60s with sex and homosexuality and abortion and in those days with sense about drugs. And we have moved on the whole in a progressive way. I'm an optimist about the way society develops. So I do think it'll develop in a decent direction here. It just simply amazed me. It's taken so long, that's all. But I'm an optimist.
And just very, very quickly from J.S. and Neil, pushing you for a prediction in 5 years' time, where do you think we'll be?
Well, I mean, I agree. I hope we're there with cannabis. But to me, more important is returning to a British sense of harm reduction and having harm reduction policies with every drug. Having harm reduction as an overriding principle in how we look at every drug is the way forward, I think. Because eventually the conclusion is the ultimate harm reduction is a regulated product.
And J.S.?
Yeah, echo what Neil says. I mean, I'd urge people to stay true to pragmatic British liberal tradition. And to me, prohibition of drugs is, you know that bit in the cartoon where the wolf has chased the bird, but then he goes off the cliff, but his legs are still whirling, but he hasn't quite looked down to realize he's run off the cliff? That's what prohibition is right now. He's off the cliff, and he's about to look down and go, pew!
I love that. That's a perfect metaphor. Well, Simon Jenkins, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
So thank you so much for listening. That's probably the last one of 2018. So we'll see you in 2019. And we got a good first one lined up. It's pretty impactful, I think. And of course, I need to do thank yous. 2018 has been a brilliant year for us. We won 2 national awards, Silver Award at the British Podcast Awards for Smartest Podcast and Best Current Affairs. We beat Blue Planet, Ed Miliband and Radio 5 Productions, which is just crazy, isn't it? The fact we're competing at that level. But we wouldn't be able to do it without the people behind us. So thank you so much, Tristan and Nikki, the producers, because without them, given hours and hours of their time, we would not be here. So thank you so much to them. Thank you to Scroobius Pip as well, because without being on his network, goodness knows we wouldn't have the exposure that we do. So thank you so much, Pip. And also, while I'm on the subject of our network, please do listen to all of our Distraction Pieces Network guys, which are Save Us a Drugs with Susie Gage, Hardcore Listener Christian Stew, Films to Be Buried with Brett Goldstein, which is just rocketing up the charts. Off the Beaten Track with Stu, which again has done really well on iTunes. And also Tuesday Night Joy, Jim Smallman, who's always brilliant. He's just fantastic. And also, thank you to My Name Is Ad for making us look pretty. Goodness knows we wouldn't be here without you either, because you give us a sheen. So thank you so much. If you need any artwork, go find My Name Is Ad. And of course, the social media. Without our 2 social media workers, John Harris on the Distraction Pieces Network, please listen to his podcast, The Dream Factory, because it's genuinely fantastic, and I'm hoping to be a guest fairly soon. And also on Leap Channels, go find John Cross, who is our tireless social media manager. He does at UKLeap on Twitter, at UKLeap Instagram, UKLeap.org on Facebook, and UKLeap.org, our website. finally getting to remember them. Right, now I've rambled on. I'm going to wish you a very, very happy new year. Thank you again for all of the interaction you give us, the shares, the likes, the nice comments, the ratings. It all helps. And we're going to do it, aren't we? We're going to achieve this. We're going to destigmatise addiction and make sure we get some degree of drug law reform pretty damn soon. So on that note, thank you so much. We'll see you again soon. Bye. Behind your barricades. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind your barricades. Where true values seldom stray.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.